Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you are in the know. I'm Brian Hackney, correspondent for CBS 5 Television in San Francisco and your moderator for tonight's show. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the Internet at commonwealthclub.org. Tonight's program is sponsored by Wells Fargo. It's an official part of the Golden Gate National Park Conservancy's 75th anniversary commemoration. Now, it's no secret that this weekend the Golden Gate Bridge turned 75, and tonight we're going to commemorate that program. It focuses on how the bridge has achieved its iconic status historically, aesthetically, and scientifically. The early 20th century was the golden age of long span suspension bridges, yet the spanning of the Golden Strait was thought to be impossible by many. Tonight we're going to present an expert panel to discuss how the bridge became an icon and why it remains one of America's most enduring symbols. We're going to be talking about its history, its construction, about what it means today, and about what's good about it, and maybe some things that aren't so good about it. I just crossed it. It cost me $6. Dr. Kevin Starr is one of America's most celebrated historians. He currently serves as University Professor of History at the University of Southern California and as California State Librarian Emeritus, having served in that post for a decade. He is the author of the ongoing multi-volume History of California, collectively entitled Americans and the California Dream. He's also the author of the book Golden Gate, The Life and Times of America's Greatest Bridge, a lyrical account of the building and significance of the Golden Gate Bridge, which he terms the quintessential image of California's breathtaking blend of nature and civilization. Dr. Starr received his BA degree from the University of San Francisco and holds a master's and a PhD from Harvard University in American Literature. Paul Giroux currently serves as Paul's on your far right. He serves as American Society of Civil Engineers chairman for the Golden Gate Bridge 75th anniversary. For 32 years, working with the Kiewit Corporation, Mr. Giroux has worked on a wide variety of heavy civil engineering mega projects throughout the U.S., including Fort McHenry Tunnel in Baltimore, several projects on the Big Dig in Boston, and most recently, the new San Francisco-Oakland Bay Bridge East Span. Mr. Giroux is the author of several bridge design and civil engineering history papers and has guest lectured at over 30 engineering schools throughout the U.S. He holds a B.S. in construction engineering from Iowa State University. And John Harper, in the middle, has been chief historian and manager of the corporate archive at Chevron Corporation since 2002. Tonight, John will focus on the photographic work of Walter Huggins, who worked at Standard Oil during the time the Golden Gate Bridge was built. We'll be showing to our audience Mr. Huggins' photos, which many say helped bring the bridge to the attention of Americans far and wide. Mr. Harper previously worked at the Office of Public Programs at the National Archives and Records Administration in Washington, D.C., and he holds a bachelor's degree in history from the College of William and Mary and a master's degree in U.S. history from the University of Maryland. Please welcome all of our panelists. Dr. Starr's book has a dedication to his grandchildren where he says he hopes that they have the same thrill that he has every time he sees that bridge. And I wonder if you remember the first time you saw the bridge. I do. I saw it when I told my mother that I was going to East Ridge, then a brand new mall in San Jose, and I grew up in a little dustburg town called, I love it, Hollister. And you will know, if you're local, that the Golden Gate Bridge is not on the way from Hollister to the East Ridge Mall. But I had an ulterior motive. My girlfriend wanted me to meet her mother at the Pomo Indian Reservation in Santa Rosa. So I told Mom that we were really going to East Ridge, and it was going to be a very long shopping trip. And for the first time in my life, I'm going up the 101 in my MGB. No airbags, no analog brakes, nothing. And I'm going past these metropoli of Mountain View and Redwood City and Burlingame, and wow, this is the big city, and I'm gliding along on the 101, and suddenly I come to San Francisco, and I'm going, what happened to the highway? I'm on Van Ness Avenue with stoplights. I don't know where I am. This is well before GPS. I go, what happened to the 101? And so stopping off at probably a standard station, which it still is on Van Ness, and picking up a map and figuring out what happened to the highway, I thought this was a progressive city. Where is the progress? Finally, I see the Golden Gate Bridge looming in my tiny windshield before me, and you gasp. And for me, on that wonderful occasion, it was a way to get out of San Francisco and see it in my rearview mirror, a function it has been providing since 1937. And even though we love it today, and I think most of us do, it's become an icon the world over. In his book, Kevin, who insists he not be called Dr. Starr, Kevin describes it as probably the most beautiful man-made object in the United States, if not on Earth. And yet, and let's begin it this way, was this something that was held by universal acclaim to be a good idea when it was first proposed?
Well, no, the bridge first proposed in 1921. Actually, Emperor Norton proposed it much earlier, but in its more recent iteration, had a number of opponents, and not to demonize any of them because they were on the wrong or right side of that. It was a question of had to be debated. The Sierra Club felt that it would profane the structure, profane the site, the structure. And if you look at that design, the initial design of two cantilevered structures with a suspension bridge in the middle, you would not want that there. So in a way, the Sierra Club had a very strong point. The War Department was very cautious because if the bridge were taken down during in wartime, it could block the port of San Francisco, which would have strategic implications. Old-time San Franciscans, just for the heck of it, didn't like it because it wasn't there already. And so they objected to it. The geology department at Stanford was, especially one member, was very critical of the suspicious of the ability of the geological structure to hold the South Pier, the San Francisco Pier. But Andrew Lawson over at the University of California at Berkeley said that it could happen, that the bridge could the pier could hold. So you had a kind of a rivalry there. And, of course, the Golden Gate ferries owned by the Southern Pacific were not necessarily anxious to give up what they thought a big chunk of the market, some 50,000 on a busy weekday, some 50,000 by the mid-1920s, some 50,000 transits back and forth in a day, making the ferry building one of the busiest, if not the second busiest, terminal of its kind in the English-speaking world. So you had all this had to be gotten through, plus some 2,000 members of the counties that formed the bridge district, and with along with Del Norte, some 2,000 individual taxpayers said they didn't want to join the bridge district, and they had the right to go to court, and the Superior Court heard some 2,000 cases. All of that front-loaded the resistance to the bridge in the 1920s, which fortunately was a very prosperous decade. Because suppose if that resistance had been front-loaded in the Depression period and then World War II broke out, we wouldn't have gotten around to the bridge until the 1950s. So, in effect, the bridge did its due diligence initially over a nine, almost 10-year period.
Yeah, if we wouldn't have gotten around to it in the 1950s, already in the 20s, for folks to go enjoy a weekend in Sausalito and North required a ferry backup on a holiday weekend of 5 hours.
Well, that's coming into Sausalito. And that's why Santa Rosa played such an important part, and Del Norte. Del Norte County and Sonoma County. We have to remember that as of 1909, some 60% of the population of the entire state lived in San Francisco and in the Bay Area. So you have a tremendous concentration. Today we have two-thirds of the state living south of the Tehachapis. So the counties to the north, starting with Marin County, which was anxious for suburban growth, Sonoma for agricultural vacation growth, Del Norte for vacation growth, knew that they would have to connect now that the society had gone automotive and that you had so much traffic through automobiles and trucks that they would have to connect with the Bay Area. And so they, Santa Rosa, Paul Doyle, Mr. Doyle, up John Doyle up in Santa Rosa, as in Doyle Drive, played a major role in convening all the politicians from the counties and getting the bridge and highway district established.
Yeah, it's interesting, too, at least my impression is that it took a lot of people who weren't in San Francisco. In fact, it's my painful duty to inform you that even the Commonwealth Club was not supportive of the bridge.
Well, the Commonwealth Club today says that it maintained a neutral and skeptical position in the spirit of social inquiry.
Yeah. I think one of its members, Arthur Byrd, was on record as saying, we don't think there will ever come a time when that bridge will carry more cars than the ferry will.
Yes. Yeah. Well, that's why I cautioned that we not demonize anybody who was against it, because it was a radical idea. Although, as I repeat, Emperor Norton and also John Charles Fremont, in writing his famous report of the exploration of the American Corps of Topographical Engineers, he wrote the report with the help of his wife, Jessie Benton Fremont, named Chrisopoe the Golden Gate. And it's not the gold of the gold rush. It's the gold of the Golden Horn, the port leading into Istanbul, classical Constantinople. Because Fremont says in that report, someday a great city will rise up on the shores of this bay, and we're going to name it after the entrance to the great city of Istanbul.
Yeah. Paul Giroux, if you were a civil engineer standing at that gate 100 years ago, let's say the soundings had been taken, you kind of knew the profile of the mouth of the gate, what were the challenges facing the technological community at the time?
The challenges would be really numerous from many perspectives. I mean, from a structural analysis perspective, it would be unprecedented 100 years ago to look at that, the distances there, and dream of any kind of a bridge structure yet built, given the materials of the time. And also you have to think in terms of the men and the machines that would try to build the project. So between the structural analysis, kind of not there quite there yet, the materials kind of still evolving. You remember with the advent of the automobile, that's really what drove like metallurgical engineering, electrical engineering, civil engineering, the mechanization of our society was driven by really the advent of the automobile and Americans' desire for more roads, more transportation, more freedom. And so really the Golden Gate Bridge 100 years ago was really nothing more than a dream. Obviously, when we get into maybe 90 years ago, we can start to have some precedent with other suspension bridges approaching those lengths. But prior to the Golden Gate Bridge being designed, the world record was 700 feet shorter. The George Washington Bridge in New York that would have been about 3,500 feet. So, you know, it was a quantum leap again, even when it was built. So, in many respects, like say 100 years ago, it would be really essentially a dream.
Okay, so enter the Pan-Pacific Exposition, 1915. Joseph Strauss is out from Chicago. And O'Shaughnessy, I think Michael O'Shaughnessy, the city engineer, and he probably meet sometime during that Pan-Pacific Exposition and discuss the concept, the idea, based, I think, on a series of articles in the local paper. Was there a movement among the engineering community in San Francisco to do it? I mean, why did it take this fellow from Chicago to go, wow, this is a project I want to put my name on?
I think Strauss is kind of really interesting. When I think of the Golden Gate Bridge, it's very much different than, say, the Brooklyn Bridge when it was built. The Brooklyn Bridge, built by the Roeblings, was the foremost bridge suspension bridge designer and builder in the world at the time, building what he knew best. When you look at the Golden Gate Bridge and Strauss, I mean, Strauss's background is movable bridges. You know, the lift bridges, the bascule bridges, that's his background. So for him to really look at that span, and to really, you know, to have the confidence and the courage to step forward like he did is remarkable when I view that. And I think to some degree it had something to do where Strauss was in his career. He had kind of been there, done that with movable bridges, and he was looking for another challenge. He was very much, a student of history with bridge engineers and viewed the opportunity of building the Golden Gate Bridge as his crowning achievement. Of course, he would... You know, and fortunately, he lived to see it opened. He died just a year after it was opened in 1937. So that was, I think, his kind of mindset. It was this kind of this thing to make his crowning achievement. And because his background was suspension bridge or movable bridges, one of the things I think is also unique to Strauss is his ability to reach out and really compile and amass a team of remarkable engineers and builders to bring it to reality.
Paul, Brian, you know that for his senior thesis at the University of Cincinnati, Strauss wrote a senior thesis about putting a bridge across the Bering Strait. So, in effect, even as a young man, he had that was residual. I agree with your analysis 100%, but he had that other side to him that was there on hold, ready for the challenge of the bridge.
Yeah. And yet his background was not in suspension structures. So, how instrumental was Joseph Strauss in making the Golden Gate Bridge a reality?
Well, I'll take the first part and then defer to Paul, because the first part, political. If you're talking politics, if you're talking about going and speaking and bringing the San Francisco Automobile Association and the Santa Rosa Farm Produce Association and doing all that political work, he was essential. In other words, he was not the designer of the bridge. Others designed it. But without that political work that he did, because O'Shaughnessy, although was there initially, O'Shaughnessy began to have all other things to do. He had the Hetch Hetchy project, which is a great project in its own way with the dam and the aqueduct. So Strauss was there. He was the Wizard of Oz behind the green curtain. He was the P.T. Barnum. He was the salesman, whatever metaphor you want to use. And I think that was essential that he carry on that work in the 20s. So, and then, you know, they say, talk about leadership. If, to be a good leader, you find a parade and then get out ahead of it. When the bridge moved to a certain point, he got himself appointed bridge engineer, and then he assembled this spectacular team. And I'll defer now to Paul, but I'm just saying that was 10 years of promotion. He was as wonderful at that.
Yeah, I agree, Kevin. I mean, if you read about Strauss, and he was not a comfortable public speaker, yet, you know, his vision, his dream, he gave him the courage, I think, to go and work tirelessly throughout the communities promoting the bridge. Speaking to, you know, assembling the team, I mean, he had already had a strong group of engineers that, again, were specialists in movable bridges. But he was smart enough to know to reach out in the engineering community for expertise. And one of the individuals he reached out to early on, as early as 1925, was Leon Moisseiff. And Moisseiff was considered the foremost theoretician in the world at the time for deflection theories and suspension bridges. When they knew the project was going to be a reality in late 1932, he sought out perhaps the best resident engineer for building suspension bridges in North America at the time, Russell G. Cohn. So he had an eye for talent, and I think that's one of the things that I think I certainly see out of Strauss. But I also think, you know, there's various junctures throughout the course of construction where Strauss demonstrated some true courage in the face of adversity. And so I see a lot of things in Strauss, I really do.
Well, the initial Strauss design for bridging the gate had been described as looking like an upside-down rat trap. Now it's this graceful suspension structure. Did that evolution take place because of his design vision or someone else's?
No, that was, you know, again, Moisseiff was brought in as early as 1925, to talk about suspension bridges, but it was dismissed at the time. So it would be really once the, you know, the bridge district gained ground, they had some funds to work with. Clifford Payne was the name, assistant chief engineer, and with the involvement of Clifford Payne, but also Charles Duther Jr., the dean of engineering at Cal Berkeley, with Leon Moisseiff, with Othmar Ammann, with all those his board of engineers coming on board. That's when Strauss's vision for the cantilevered suspension upside-down rat trap fades into the sunset in favor of a suspension bridge.
He had a good sense not to make an argument for it once he assembled his team.
Yeah, yeah.
But that was the image that was put forth in the early to mid-20s, that image, and I think that fueled some of the opposition, say, from the Sierra Club about saying that it was inappropriate for the site because it's not a very beautiful structure. It would have not have been a beautiful structure
right.
if that
yeah.
had been built.
Yeah. Well, finally, now, this bridge was built with no federal help. It was built with no state help. Who paid for it?
Well, it's the taxpayers paid for the initial phase of design and setting up the district, renting the property in the Russ building, et cetera. And that was what the lawsuits were, so those didn't want to pay those taxes. But then it was financed by the Bank of America, revenue bonds. And the decision was personally made by A.P. Giannini. Strauss called on A.P. Giannini, and you could see these two titanic personalities in the same room discussing this great project, the bridge. I would have loved to have been there to have overheard the conversation. But we do know from the report that Giannini said, how long will it last? And Strauss, with typical modesty, said forever. And Giannini took the bonds. Now, these were revenue bonds. Giannini bought them at 3%. He was 2.2% below what it should have been, but later they were able to adjust it up. So it's a remarkable work of act of courage on the part of Giannini, and very typical of him. Later he would buy the finance Kaiser Permanente. He would finance Hollywood Studios. So Giannini had an eye, as any great banker must have, for a risk worth taking.
Right.
I'd like to add, I think what's significant about, you know, the, you know, Giannini taking the bonds when he did it is the timeline. So this is in the, you know, you have October of 29, you have the stock market crash. Mm-hmm. It's in after that is when the counties approved the bond measure. It's after, you know, in the depression and the peak of it when Giannini had the courage to take the bond. So to me, again, I think that speaks volumes not only about Giannini's sense in his desire to stimulate growth in the economy through infrastructure investment, but also the courage of all the society, you know, the Bay Area citizens to step forward with the bridge at that time in the face of so much uncertainty.
And the voters, too. When the bond issue was finally put to the voters, I think the vote was 146,000 to 45,000, essentially 3-1 yeah. four. And did that seal the deal? I mean, once voters approved it, was it full steam ahead?
And once voters approved it and the bonds were bought, yes.
Okay.
And the plans were done. I'll have to defer to Paul by that. But, Paul, that the beautiful plan, three volumes report, that when does that, that comes out, I forget what year, and the construction starts sort of more or less right after that.
But the original report was August of 1930, and the plans weren't really finalized until 31.
31.
And then they went out to bid. There was two rounds of bidding. There was an initial round of biddings of July in 31. Those bids could not be accepted because of the lingering legal issues about the authority of the bridge district to levy taxes. So those bonds lapsed, and then that second round of bonding had to be approved, and that's where Bank of America stepped in.
But by the time that report's issued, the bridge is there in all its grandeur. It is designed. It is. I'm sure it was tinkered with after that, but you see the essential. Now, the state had something. The state did play a role. Obviously, the state didn't play the role that it did with the San Francisco-Oakland Bay Bridge, where the Division of Highways actually built the bridge under the direction of Charles Purcell. But the state, the Sausalito turnoff, the Doyle Drive entrance, the state highways were very cooperative and had certain jurisdictions beyond the bridge in terms of servicing the feeder areas there.
The viaducts and all
yes.
that. Yeah. So, construction is underway. We break ground on January 5th, 1933. And to record the construction, John Harper, tell me the story of Ted Huggins.
Let's back up a few years and establish the context in which Ted Huggins joined Standard Oil Company of California, Chevron now. Chevron Standard was founded in this city, actually, in 1879. And ever since then was keenly interested in the state's economic development. In the 1920s, the president of Standard Oil Company of California, an individual very enlightened named Kenneth Kingsbury, helped establish an organization, a nonprofit organization called Californians Incorporated. It was very much interested and focused in attracting residents to the state and tourism. 3 years later, the company, Standard Oil Company, joined the Redwood Empire Association, which represented the counties north, Marin, all the way up to Oregon. In fact, Josephine County going into Oregon. It's called Redwood Empire Association because 97% of the redwoods were located in that area, 97% of the world. So the company, that organization, was very much interested in developing the highway, the state and national highway system in the Redwood District, Redwood Empire. And the Standard Oil was behind that effort, too, to increase tourism, automobile traffic, and, of course, to sell more gasoline. So when Ted Huggins enters the picture in 1931, he comes under the leadership of this Kenneth Kingsbury, someone who's very concerned about the welfare of the state. And Ted Huggins comes in as a salesman, a very talented salesman. In fact, he became a part of the Wonder Team, the sales team for the company. He was that talented. So these traits actually made him a very good public relations person for the company, which he quickly transitioned into in 1932. Now, Ted served on the Publicity and Events Committee for the groundbreaking ceremonies at Crissy Field in 1933. And then he started to think more about what the company could do aside from chipping in and helping with the PA system for the event, what they could do for the bridge project, since this was going to stimulate interest in the West. He got the idea to take photos of the bridge's construction, and Ted Huggins from Berkeley was an amateur photographer. He didn't have any formal training in photography. So he pitched this idea to his boss, a man named Philip Patchen at Standard Oil, and they agreed that with Kingsbury's backing, Huggins would provide as many photographs as he could to the Golden Gate Bridge and Highway District free of charge, since the district did not have a budget to do such a thing. This, in turn, would allow the district to distribute these images to news agencies worldwide. And that's really how, in one way, the bridge started to come into the conscience of the world. See these photographs that Ted took, probably his most famous, graced the cover of the May 31st, 1937 edition of Life magazine. And that we see it, pretty much the completed bridge from a bird's eye view of one of the towers looking down. And he took hundreds of these photographs to promote the bridge free of charge. He devoted most of his waking hours, as Carol attests to, studying the bridge, where to take the photographs, even going up into dirigibles and even blimps to take photographs of this bridge in all hours. And his legacy has been these hundreds of photographs that now reside in the California Historical Society, and some of which you can see up here on the screen. And they really do serve as a visual record of the architectural and engineering masterpiece that the bridge is. And they not only reflect, but I think they amplify the enormity of the project that was the Golden Gate Bridge and really reflect the enormous dream that it was as well.
During the construction, how many workers were employed? How much were they paid?
Well, it was kind of interesting. At that time, I mean, there was a certain amount of unskilled labor that's always required to build projects, but there's also a lot of skilled labor building suspension bridge. So, back then, in spite of the hazards of building, working on in the depths, some of the divers working in the ocean with the currents and the big swells that would come through the strait, in spite of working 750 feet off the water, hundreds of people would line up for a good paying job. And a good paying job back then on the bridge was $4 a day for unskilled labor, $11 a day if you were highly skilled. So, the workers back at the time, they knew if they didn't do what was required during the day, if they slacked off, there was someone waiting to take their place.
It was during the depths of the Depression.
It was.
Yeah. I'm fascinated by the idea of designing this structure that needs to thermally expand, that needs to withstand high winds, that needs to bear a traffic load. And they didn't have an HP 35 calculator. They didn't have anything like a computer. Kevin, at the time, one of the mathematician behind this project was a guy named Charles Ellis.
Charles Alton Ellis, yes. He was a professor at the University of Illinois and had worked with Strauss. He was the vice president of his company, later a longtime professor at Purdue, and he worked on the mathematics with a big chief tablet and a number two pencil. And the mathematics were later published in the 1939 report, and for me as a non-engineer, just to see the mathematics move so magnificently across the page, I'm convinced the bridge will stand. But there's almost something mystical that mathematics could do, that an individual working out the computations could do that. But Strauss got very impatient as they were moving towards construction time, and he took the project away from Ellis and gave it to Clifford Payne, who finished it. And I think one of the great things that's occurred over time, it began with John Vanderzee's book, The Gate, 1985, is that Charles Alton Ellis' contribution is now, it was not mentioned at the time, he was just forgotten. And now that contribution is coming back, and in fact the Bridge District will be putting some kind of commemoration there to make sure that that last great designer of that team gets acknowledged.
Yeah, in fact, I'll be involved with that ceremony tomorrow. I'll be presiding over plaque dedication to Charles Ellis. We actually have the American Society of Civil Engineers president, Andrew Herman, will be in town for that event as well. So it's a real source of pride for us, obviously, to be involved. It's part of our engineering heritage, and to recognize Ellis, albeit 75 years too late, is something we definitely are proud of being able to do.
Ellis was from Maine. He was an old Anglo-American Yankee. He read Greek, ancient Greek, fluently. And I emphasize that because there's something almost Pythagorean or mystical in his ability to handle math. And if you look at the team that Strauss assembled, it was a remarkable case study in where America was being peopled, who peopled America. Alton Ellis was from old 17th century stock, and Leon Mosieff was from Latvia, and Othmar Oman was from Switzerland, and the Duluth, as you say, was from here, the Bay Area. So you have this marvelous representative crossing immigrants, crossing religious inclusiveness, etc. And I like that kind of sense of that. I mean, I don't think Strauss sat down and had affirmative action, but he assembled a team very representative of the great energies of this country, of the old founders of the country, represented by Alton Ellis, and the new dynamic, brilliantly trained immigrants who were coming in. It was just a wonderful team.
One thing that was missing, though, is there was no racial diversity.
You can't have Falstaff and have him lean. The civil rights movement did not happen in the 1930s or the 1920s. Mm-hmm. Civil rights movement started a little bit in the 50s, but really the 1960s. And so we just have to accept that fact. It's a tragic fact, and it should remind us of how far we've come and maybe how far we have to go still. There is some documentation of African-American workers, but very few. Most of the pictures that Mr. Huggins took are pictures of white workers. And that's the drama, really, of World War II in the Bay Area. Because in Southern California as well, World War II brought an enormous number of African-American workers up from the South, from Louisiana especially, and changed that complexion of the working force. But we just have to acknowledge that yes, indeed, there was. I've never come across a document saying anything about it, saying African-American people can't work here or Asian-American people can't work here. It was not said, but it was practiced.
I see. Paul, also I'm curious, did the work, for instance, that Charles Ellis did he do it with, I don't know, a CRC standard table of integrals and a slide rule?
About a month ago, I was at Purdue University, and I was visiting with the structural engineering faculty there, and really what it was just a commemoration of the life and times, if you will, of Charles Ellis. I mean, Ellis had taught at Purdue for almost, I think it was about 14 years, from 19, I think he started in 1934, and he taught until 1946. So he's very much a favorite son of Purdue University, and someone that's part of their heritage, and they still understand and follow Ellis. And I remember them, the faculty, talking about Ellis's calculations and how amazing they were for its time and how they were eloquent and refined. But what struck the faculty was the fact that he did these essentially by hand, and that his matrices that he would look for variables. He was putting in sometimes 30 to 38 variables into one equation. And so when you put that, you know, and today that's something that most of us won't even try. I mean, you know, they were very much humbled. And I think that speaks volumes. If you think about modern faculty with all the tools that they have at their disposal, and looking back at what Ellis did with the tools he had, and be humbled by that, I think, again, it speaks volumes about Ellis.
Let me ask a naive question. Was it a dangerous job, putting the bridge up?
You know, there was a saying back in the early 20th century for bridge builders. There was a saying that every bridge demands its life. And it sounds harsh now, but it was kind of recognized that, you know, when you build a bridge, it's going to take life. And there was a rule of thumb that builders had. For every $1 million of construction cost, you could expect one fatality. So the question, and I think, you know, I'm a builder. That's what I do. And so when I look at the photographs and I read when I read the reports, I tend to read between the lines. I almost feel like I'm there. And I think that Strauss and Ellis and Payne were very much aware of the safety risk involved with the bridge. And to very much to Strauss's credit, he was determined to build the Golden Gate Bridge to the highest safety standards. And they actually went about 2.5 years with no fatalities on some of the riskiest work that you can imagine in building the piers and some of the tower work. So it wasn't until they were involved with the superstructure construction that they had their first fatality. Ultimately, there would be 11 lives lost in the construction of the bridge, and which had beat the statistical average, if you will, of one life per $1 million of cost. But I think it was something that very much weighed on Strauss for the rest of his life.
I think to Ted Huggins' credit, he was able to photograph from these dizzying heights and these angles that really conveyed to the viewer the danger inherent in building the bridge. And if you see some more of the photographs at the Historical Society or online at tedhuggins.com, you will see the vantage point which sometimes he takes, where it's just this, it's in this dizzying height where he's looking down hundreds of feet, and there are workers from hanging from suspender cables alone in midair, it seems. So to his credit, I think he really showed the bravery involved in building that bridge.
We have to remember also that some 22 workers fell into the net, and they would have been mostly casualties, the Halfway to Hell Club.
Right.
In fact, there's one of the reports I read that there was some suspicion that some of the younger people dove into the net, and that Russ Cohen, the supervising engineer, said he'd fire anybody who did that. So without that big Manila net put there, there would have been a much higher one is too many, but there would have been a much higher number, I think.
And that was a reflection of Strauss's dedication to safety. He spent $100,000 on the
net,
I think.
And also, if you came to work Monday morning, you look hungover, you had to drink a quart of sauerkraut juice. He was there making sure that nobody hungover would go up there. Also, Russ Cohen and the companies had a policy that if you were up on the high steel and you finished your job, you didn't have to make work. You didn't have to sort of run around and sweep up and pick up cigarette butts or try. You stood there and then you took care of yourself, and then other tasks would be given you. So there was a real high level of safety consciousness, and I think that speaks really highly of Strauss's emphasis on the hard hats, which were basically a kind of leather.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. You know, like many of you, if you've read books about the Golden Gate Bridge, sometimes they will attribute, those are maybe the first use of hard hats on a major construction project. It was, in fact, at Hoover Dam. Hoover Dam started a couple years early. It started in 1931. And the high scalers that were cleaning the rock off the cliffs of Boulder Canyon, it's actually Black Canyon where they build it, but they were cleaning the rock, and they were tired of their friends knocking rocks down on their heads. So they came up, and they took two ball caps back-to-back, dipped them in hot tar, and they called them hard-boiled hats. And Frank Crow, the superintendent at Hoover Dam, liked them so much, he bought them for everyone. Now, it just so happens that one of the companies involved with the Hoover Dam construction was Pacific Bridge, who was also involved with building the Golden Gate Bridge. And they took I think that's what brought the idea of hard hats up to the Golden Gate, was the involvement of Pacific Bridge.
I need to remind our listening audience that you are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. We're commemorating the 75th anniversary of the Golden Gate Bridge and discussing its iconic status. Our panelists are Dr. Kevin Starr, California State Librarian Emeritus and Professor of History at USC, Paul Giroux, American Society of Civil Engineers Chairman for the Golden Gate Bridge 75th anniversary, and John Harper, Chief Historian and Manager of the Chevron Corporate Archive. The Golden Gate Bridge, did it come in on time and under budget?
Yes, it did. But how that was done, I defer to Paul, because the possibility of cost overruns must have been multiple.
I think back on I spent almost 8 years on the Big Dig in Boston, and I'm still in therapy, but... But again, when you go through experiences like that, and then you look at looking at something like the Golden Gate Bridge, and you realize, every time you open up the ground, you open up Mother Nature, you open up the earth, there's always going to be surprises. And the fact they kind of got through the geological issues at the site without any major hurdles, that was pretty remarkable. It was more so is that I think the environmental conditions of the site, the cold, the fog. The wind, of course, the ocean swells, and many occasions that just the nature of the physical site is really what gave the builders the problems.
And it was a golden age of construction. If you think, we mentioned Hoover Dam and the Hetch Hetchy under construction. A little later, the Grand Coulee Dam, and of course the Golden Gate Bridge and San Francisco Oakland Bay Bridge. And the private companies who were the subcontractors, like Shea and Bethlehem Steel, these were experienced companies, top companies. And so I think that wonderful blend of public-private, the Bridge District is a quasi-public, distinctive kind of entity. It could set standards, and then the private companies were not interfered with in terms of as they moved along and kept the project working. So I think it was a beautiful model of construction management, and it didn't seem to have the social problems that surfaced in the Boulder Dam project. There was a number of worker problems, et cetera, et cetera. I don't know of any walk-offs. Maybe John would know of any walk-offs or any problems like that. Russ Cohen's management must have been wonderful, because they were steady and whatever. Human nature being what it is, difficulties came up, but there was no major labor problems there.
Russ Cohen being the construction manager for the Golden Gate Bridge, and you described him as kind of a man's man, sort of.
Oh, he was superb. He had been a lot of these people had been engineers during World War I in the United States Army Corps of Engineers, and Russ Cohen was that. And incidentally, Russ Cohen's son, Russ Cohen Jr., was a longtime very distinguished reporter for the San Francisco Examiner.
Well, yeah. Russell Cohen, by the way, made $10,000 a year for doing that job, which I guess was pretty good money at the time.
Yeah.
The color of the bridge. Tell us this famous story, whoever would like to.
I'll give it a try. You mentioned earlier the Panama Pacific Exposition of 15. The exposition had a color consultant. Jules Guérin is a French architect with emphasis on color. He understood color, and he studied very carefully the atmospherics of San Francisco Bay, the Bayside, with the marvelous changes of light, the fog, the mixture of sunshine and maritime weather, all those the atmospheric, very distinctive atmospherics, and he came up with a palette of colors for the Panama Pacific. If you've seen colored pictures of the Pacific buildings, they were remarkable colors, yeah. Cinnabar and mauve, and one of them was cerulean blue, one of them was international, what we call today international orange. So that had a sort of little test. It was there in a small way, but it was the color of the primer. The primer that once the bridge structure was there, it was the color of the primer, and they painted it while they were deciding what to do. The War Department was very interested in having a dark surface with maybe yellow stripes, or yellow with black stripes, so that airplanes coming in or ships coming in from offshore could see the bridge. And lo and behold, Irving Morrow was just delighted with the primer, the architect, and Benjamin Bufano, who was a San Francisco sculptor, Maynard Dixon, a very distinguished San Francisco artist who does a beautiful painting of the Golden Gate Bridge, even before the full design was released, they began to say, wait a minute, if it's not broke, don't fix it. That's the color. And I think that's the final design element. I'm not going to agitate that Jules Guérin be given a plaque there at the bridge, but because his work was for the Panama Pacific. But in a way, it's a wonderful continuity between the Panama Pacific, which was a fulfillment of the City Beautiful that was designed by Burnham for San Francisco in 1905, and after the earthquake and fire guided us in things like the Ocean Beach, the Civic Center, the Stockton Tunnel, the Twin Peaks Tunnel, and then the Panama Pacific was a fulfillment of the City Beautiful, and the Golden Gate Bridge then comes out of the City Beautiful movement, enhanced by the artistic community. Arthur Matthews and his wife Lucia Matthews had a magazine, Philopolis, Love of the City, in which they projected what San Francisco should look like in the years to come as it rebuilt itself. You can see those murals, for instance, today at in the basement area there of the State Capitol in Sacramento, and those colors, that, to include International Orange, appear on that palette. So it was just the color was a natural development coming out of the City Beautiful impulse and coming out of the tremendous artistic response to the Bay on the part of artists, architects, and Jules Guérin.
David, ever think about painting it golden?
Oh, I think, of course, De gustibus non disputandem praeter necessitatem. I learned that in high school. About high school Latin class. Concerning taste, you shouldn't argue. But I think gold with that kind of yellowish dominance would just not have had the ability to assert itself. I don't want to criticize the bridge in Sacramento, but but they did it gold, and I just don't. I think International Orange embodies the idea of gold in dialogue with the atmospherics of the Golden Gate Strait.
Got it.
My opinion.
Yeah.
I'm partial to Garcia, by the way.
Let's talk about how the bridge has functioned technically. Tell me about what happened on May 27th. 1987.
I'll be careful what I say there, because my friends at the Bridge District might be listening. But it was, I think it's an outpouring of love. I mean, we just collectively, the community gave the bridge a big hug, and it kind of strained a little bit, but it did not go beyond its design capacity. One of the things that's remarkable about that is I've read different accounts from different lay people, from engineers that were on the bridge at the time. And it was a little bit, if any of you were on there, they said it was very crowded, almost claustrophobic at some points of time. But I'd also think it speaks volumes if you look at that event and the ability to weather, that much, load at, that time. It's kind of hard. It's kind of counterintuitive, right, to think about solid people being heavier than solid cars. But in fact, it isn't true. So when I look at that particular event, I think go back to Ellis, and I think about his ability to, not design right up to the ragged edge, but have that inherent factor of safety, and also him understanding truly how a suspension bridge lives and breathes. It flexes, it bows, it bends. It's designed to do that. It's not a rigid structure like a cantilever bridge. So his ability to, really to tune the bridge so as the stresses pick up, they can shed stress uniformly without any one particular member becoming overstressed and then failing. So,
and also the people behave well. Even though it was a very frightening situation, the bridge was swaying, and there was an impact, and some 300,000 people, one or two drunks got arrested, but that's par for the course. You get 300,000 people. A few children were separated from their parents but reunited. There were no fistfights. There was one fatality from a heart attack. But other than that, the people behaved magnificently, especially as they waited then for the bridge to empty out on either side. So I think it said something about the civility of the bridge being reflected in the civility of the behavior of the crowd.
I do remember, Professor Starr, in your book, you do mention that if it hadn't been for the fact that a lighter roadway had been placed on the roadbed the year before.
Well, a reinforced roadway. And the full technical details, I'll defer to Paul on that. But there had been, I can't say or something would have happened, because that's not out of my ability. But let's put it this way. It's a wonderful thing that it was toned up, et cetera, when I had to face that. No one would argue that it didn't need to be toned up. It was toned up, the roadway, and it was fortunate that it was done before that particular event occurred. But I'm not saying that either there would have been, because it's almost, to contemplate what might have happened is almost...
unimaginable.
Unimaginable, that's it. That's yeah. Exactly.
Paul, you're saying we didn't come close to that.
No, I've read various accounts of it, and I think it was well within its design factor of safety. In fact, the bridge is designed to deflect down 11 feet at midspan and as high as and go upward as much as 6. So it has 16, 17 feet of range in its normal operating parameter. So
it went down 10, didn't it?
I don't remember the exact deflection.
So we could have taken another 7.
Yeah. And also during the storm of December 1st, 1951, it reached some of its, almost its undulating extremes, and after that it had to be strengthened.
Yeah, so in the 50s they did some additional lateral wind bracing on the main superstructure truss, and so that was in the 50s. But then we talked about, lightening the dead load, right before the 50th anniversary, and they took off the original reinforced concrete deck and put an orthotropic steel deck down. So all these things, I think, again, these things go back and they speak about really the vigilance and the stewardship of the bridge district to monitor and maintain the bridge, not just to make it keep looking pretty, but, upgrade it structurally for based upon modern knowledge of seismic events.
May I say something in defense of in praise of the bridge district? In the 1950s, there was a big movement to just integrate all bridges, highways, in the Bay Area into one mega system. The 1950s loved General Foods, General Electric, General Motors, general things. They loved to bring everything together. And fortunately, the voters turned that down, because I think the distinctive elements of the bridge district, the bridge is so distinct to have its own particular distinctive political entity take care of it, as long as it's representing all the counties, etc. I think it's been a wonderful development. I would not have liked to have seen the Golden Gate Bridge managed just along with everything else in the state.
One footnote on the Pedestrian Day in 1987, it was an echo of Pedestrian Day, May 27, 1937. I think I might be reading Carol's mind, in which her husband suggested that Pedestrian Day happen. Ted Huggins suggested that they have a pedestrian day one day before the bridge was opened up to cars, and it was received, and it actually happened. I think 200,000 people crossed the bridge that time. I'm not sure in 1987 how many people estimated crossed.
Well, they say towards 300,000 might have been.
Yeah, I think their issue wasn't they didn't cross it. They just, once they got on it, they just stayed there.
Right. Yeah. One of our audience members, the topic comes up inevitably. It has to. It's achieved iconic status. It's a gorgeous bridge. It's also a magnet for suicides. It's the second top destination next to a Japanese volcano.
Well, yes, some 1,400 estimated suicides. And you remember in high school physics, we learned for every reaction, there's an equal and opposite reaction. For every action, there's an equal opposite reaction. And I think everything we've been saying about the bridge, its beauty, its enhancement of life, its celebratory quality, also has the other side. That could speak to someone in a condition of despair and trouble, etc. All that could speak in a negative way, or in a way that has a kind of fatal attraction. And I think over time, an issue with the bridge, we just let it go. The Colorado bridge down in Pasadena had a similar problem. They put up a huge barrier, and it was when it was opened up about 1911. And I think as our society has matured, we've taken more and more of an attitude of preventative mental hygiene, really, against the whole suicide problem. And the suicide activists, the suicide prevention people, have really raised the consciousness of it. And the bridge district has a very active program to prevent, even now, to prevent suicides, and has a level of success. Some 100 people last year apparently saved or prevented. And then with the authorization of the net, I think we're moving along in the way that we can. But ultimately, I don't think we ever can, even with that net, prevent ultimately some people who want to do themselves in will be successful. It's really not the bridge's fault. It's our fault if we don't do everything that we can to prevent it. But once it happens in the future, there's a certain part of what Unamuno calls the tragic sense of life. Some people are really very afflicted and their lives.
Yeah. We did say we were going to open up the microphone to some audience members. So if you have a question, I can think of no other way other than forming a line behind the microphone. And while we do, let me ask you this. Is there an Achilles heel to the Golden Gate Bridge that you look at it and think, gee, technically, this is a problem? Or does it work beautifully based on slide rules and integral tables?
I think from an engineering perspective, I think it's just it was just a purely elegant solution to a monumental problem. I mean, to build, 4,200-foot main span when they did, it speaks volumes again about, I think, the collective knowledge that was brought to bear with the Board of Engineers. But there was always push and pull in these, finding elegant solutions. And one thing, Mo Sieff, again, one of the most foremost theoreticians on suspension bridge designs, but his next bridge after Golden Gate was Tacoma Narrows number 1 that blew down in Gallup and Gertie, that blew down in 1940. So Mo Sieff was at the forefront. Unfortunately, with Tacoma Narrows, he pushed too far. And so I can envision there being these debates going on with Ellis, with Amon, with Derleth. All these people would have been involved in these debates. Fortunately, they leaned on the conservative side. It's robust, yet it's elegant. And it's, to me, its elegance is derived from its structural efficiency. It's just a perfect, to me, it's a perfect blend of form and function.
And we have a question from you.
Yes. You have not said, I don't believe, that who or what group of people was responsible for the artistic design of the bridge. In other words, what it looks like. And I had the impression that it was Ellis, but you're saying he was primarily the mathematician. So who came up with the Art Nouveau design that makes it what it is?
Well, I would just quote what Paul just said. First of all, you begin with form and function. It's so elegantly designed that the engineering itself is beautiful. Now, there is a decorative element in the towers, and that's twofold. John Boardman was a theatrical designer, did some early suggestions to Strauss for the towers. And then Irving Marl, the architect who designed those Art Deco chevron plates that gave the design, and then the color. So, but if you didn't have the fundamental form and function that Paul just suggested, no amount of decoration could cover it over. But because the form and function were there so beautifully, the decoration was just enough to enhance it beautifully. And I think in terms of, say, the Art Deco period of the 1930s, we think of Rockefeller Center, the head of the top of the Chrysler Building, maybe the Paramount Theater, Timothy Pfluger's Paramount Theater over in Oakland, and certainly the Golden Gate Bridge, one of the great instances of Art Deco on a great, lavish fest. There's something festive about Art Deco, and there's something festive about those towers.
Sir?
Yes, I'm looking for maybe your thoughts or reflection on whether California and the Bay Area today have the will, the courage, the ability to pursue Golden Gate Bridge-level projects.
Don't look at me.
Well, that's an individual choice. I think as long as we take into consideration that there was that sharp 9-year debate, that we don't just say the bridge was just without a debate and controversy, and if we also realize that a society of 6, 7, 8 million people is very different from a society of 39 or 40 million people, and the rising elements of environmentalism and procedures, etc. So we have a more complicated, more regulated society today. So I think we can do it. We'll be doing things, but it will be increasingly difficult. That's the trade-off we make for the safety and the other kinds of guarantees and the environmentalism that we legitimately insist upon. Still, having said that, I think the Golden Gate Bridge is breathtaking in the swiftness with which, once it was decided what to do, how quickly it was done.
That's right. I mean, a construction period of 4.5 years. But if I could maybe comment a little bit more, I mean, if you look at what we're doing now with the renovations and rebuilding of the east span of the San Francisco-Oakland Bay Bridge from 1989 until opening, that'll be a period of almost 25 years. And 14 years of that was really what you might call the debate phase and the design phase before the construction started on the new east span in 2003. So,
please.
Are there protective measures in place against terrorism, like a no-fly zone?
Well, I'm not in the Bridge District, but I don't think Paul probably knows more than he's willing to talk about. I don't think the Bridge District talks about what its protective measures are, but I'm sure since 9/11 they've been there.
I know for years I've begged Mary Curry, the spokesman for the district, to go do a stand-up at the top of the tower, and she said, not since 2001. So they guard it pretty carefully. They don't let people inside of it anymore, but no-fly zones, I don't know. Yes, ma'am.
Yes, I'm wondering how and why May 27 was selected. Did the work just finish by then, or had they chosen this date ahead of time and worked really hard to get it done? And it's very personal because being a native San Franciscan who adores the city, I chose that as my wedding day.
Oh.
Well, I think the main driver of that was that the bridge was finished, and then there was a speed up, and Paul can speak of this a little more towards the end of getting the roadways done correctly and bringing them up to speed. And I think May's a wonderful time, isn't it? to have a festival. A week-long festival, the Fiesta. It was a remarkable fiesta. It had radio broadcasts. It had a flyover by the Army Air Service. It had a parade of naval ships. It was a wonderful event because there was a sense that, all right, we have a depression, but let's take a week and celebrate this sense of renewal that this bridge is offering us.
You know, and I apologize to you. We're about out of time, and I have to cover one last thing, which is how and why has the bridge achieved such iconic status of San Francisco? And Paul, maybe I'll have you start.
Yeah, as I reflect on my involvement with the Brooklyn Bridge 125th anniversary, and now the Golden Gate 75th, there's a lot of similarities there, and I think. Obviously, an icon is something that represents something to each of us. And I think in modern times, we look at an icon on our computer, and that it's a pathway or portal to somewhere else. And when we look at the Golden Gate Bridge, I think it's a portal for us. It takes us to another place. It to each of us, it's a personal thing. To the commuter, it's a safe passage over the bridge. To the engineer, I look at it and I see efficient flow of physical forces and structural efficiency. As a builder, I look at it and I remark about, I'm just taken back by the resolve of the builders and their creativity. So it speaks a lot to us as individuals, I think. But then it also has a shared meaning. And I think, I remember Paul Goldberger of the New York Times. He wrote on the 100-year anniversary of the Brooklyn Bridge, he said, a monument is simply not a big structure or a grandiose one. It is a structure that has or acquires over time a shared meaning in a sense that it connects in some way to the daily lives of the people who see it. So I think there's this shared meaning that we have of the Golden Gate Bridge. And in a way, it's the same shared meaning that we have with the original people of the Bay Area who dreamt of that bridge, because it's the Bay Bridge or the Golden Gate Bridge. It's a bridge that speaks to our hopes, our dreams, and our optimism of the future.
Professor Stark.
Well, it's hard to just a series of footnote to that eloquent presentation. I just would remind, going back to my high school Greek, that an icon was obviously an image, but in Greek Orthodoxy, it's an image through which is channeled a certain power. That the image is not just a picture of something, it is something. And I think the bridge is that. The bridge channels a certain power. The Brooklyn Bridge was interpreted by Joseph Stella, Lewis Mumford, Hart Crane, his wonderful poem, The Bridge, as this iconographic sense that the rising 20th century American industrial city, industrial culture that could be good, could produce beautiful things in with a sense of stewardship. I think the Golden Gate Bridge makes a similar suggestion, but I think the best, as far as its fundamental message is concerned, the best is yet to come.
And on that note, our thanks to Dr. Kevin Starr, California State Librarian Emeritus, Professor of History at the University of Southern California, and author of Golden Gate, The Life and Times of America's Greatest Bridge. Paul Giroux, American Society of Civil Engineers, Chairman for the Golden Gate Bridge 75th Anniversary. And John Harper, Chief Historian and Manager of the Chevron Corporate Archive. We also thank our audiences here and on radio, television, and the Internet. Tonight's program has been sponsored by Wells Fargo. It's an official part of the Golden Gate National Parks Conservancy's 75th anniversary commemoration. I'm Brian Hackney of CBS 5 Television, and now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.